I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about the author Peter Matheson and also about building a better life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. The author and naturalist Peter Matheson died of leukemia this weekend at his home in Sagaponack on the East End of Long Island. He was an environmentalist, author of 30 books, and the only author to win a National Book Award for both his fiction and nonfiction work. He began the Paris Review with George Plimpton as editor, but the two had a rough patch. A documentary came out revealing that Matheson worked for the CIA in Paris, finding out about Americans traveling there. He used the Paris Review as a cover, he admitted, though he said it was not a CIA tool in any way. I met Peter Matheson 2 years ago when the Faith Middleton Show had a summer satellite studio at Wolfer Vineyard on the East End. In walked this tall, thin, elegant man, weathered skin, quiet, someone who'd grown up with privilege and a Zen Buddhist priest and writer, and he wanted to shed all that. He did so successfully. He was loved and admired. We began talking about his book, Shadow Country, which won the National Book Award. I wanted to know why he chose that title.
Shadow Country, well, because it's a shadow over the land, and Watson was a frontier killer, in a way, looking at it from one point of view, but that's only one point of view. And I think there was a shadow of race there in Florida at that time, not only black people, but also American Indian people, and a shadow of destruction of the environment, not just the peoples, which is still going strong. I think it was that. Also, there was kind of an atmosphere over the Everglades of these very heavy cumulus clouds coming in off the Gulf, and there were shadows moving across that river of grass, as Marjorie Douglas called it. So all those things. I wanted something faintly ominous there.
Well, that you did it. Do you have time to read for pleasure?
Yes. Not as much as I like, but I do.
What are you reading right now?
Well, I'm reading several books. The book that I think has struck me most in recent weeks is another very long book by a man named Roberto Bolaño. He's a Chilean, late Chilean. He died a few years ago at the age of 51. And he's a terrific writer. And I think this book is one of the great books of the century. I do, really. He's best known for a book called Something Thief. And there's another one called Nights in Chile. And there's several shorter novels. This is called 2666. And it's four or five disparate stories, really. But they all come together at Ciudad Juarez, which is the place where all the women are being, strangely, serial murders there, hundreds of them being found there. So it's the most sinister place on the planet, except possibly Syria. And I don't know how much that really has to do. It gives a kind of a mood like shadow in shadow country, that the place is so, it's drug cartels, senseless killings and slaughters, and the Mexican army called in to try to control it, and they've only made it worse. So, but anyway, he's just astoundingly well-informed. He writes beautifully, at times very funny in a dark way, but interesting, and his control of facts and events and everything he does is just, it's like Garcia Marquez, but without that magic realism, so-called, element, and even some of that.
This is the writer Peter Matheson, who lives here in Southampton. We're on the East End of Long Island. I taught a course on the art of the interview at Yale, and because I love it, I used as one of the source books for that course the Paris Review. So I was looking up your involvement in the founding of the Paris Review in the 1950s, and in this notation, it said that at the time of the founding of the Paris Review, Peter Matheson was in the CIA. And I thought, is that possible? Is that true?
Yes, I'm afraid it's true. It's the one I've said before. It's the one adventure in my life. I've had a lot of great adventures. That's the one adventure I regret. I don't regret. You know, when I went in, I was signed up when I was still in college by a favorite professor in the grad school who happened to be a pal of another Yale person named James Angleton, who was a well-known CIA counterintelligence officer. And it seemed like a great idea. My wife and I had met in Paris. We got married in 1950, and I had no job. And she adored Paris. We both did. It was a very romantic place for us. And it was more or less a condition of my joining up. I needed a salary. I wanted to go to Paris, and I was writing my first novel, too, called Race Rock. So that was done in Paris. So I had all these reasons to go, in addition to my so-called patriotism being appealed to do something for your country. Now, in those days, the CIA was not up to all the dirty tricks it's famous for today. It had just really begun. It was an extension of the OSS for World War II. And the Cold War was just beginning. So it did seem like a kind of a, at least that wasn't my real reason, but it did seem like a patriotic thing to do. But as I got into it and the more I learned, and I quit on my first job.
What was your first job?
Well, I'm not, unfortunately, permitted to say, but it was mainly my job is telling lies.
I was going to say, did you have to skulk about at night and that kind of thing?
Everything I did not want to do and was not used to and everything like that.
Our dear friend, Julia Child, all the time that we knew her, was also in the same service and would never, ever, for all her life, only after her death did it come out, would she talk about it like you. She kept that promise.
It's not so much a promise, it's also legal. You can get in hot water for doing that. I actually, I said, oh, the hell with it. And after a few years, I was so anti the CIA. CIA made a left winger out of me. So I told George Plimpton about it because he deserved to know. This is 8 years after the parachute started. And then Doc Humes, who was the third founder, I told him eventually too. And anyhow, it began to get around. And then it appeared in the New York Times in 1978. I never talked about it, but I never denied it either if it came up.
You didn't lose any friends over it?
Oh, I don't know. It's a lot of people who are kind of armchair patriots who never took a risk in their life were very indignant about my... Oh, yes, they were armchair liberals. They didn't, you know, they'd never been... and they were the ones who got the most outraged.
Can we finally set the record straight? Did Peter Benchley write Jaws because he was inspired by something that you wrote? Because that is the case that gets made. And I thought, I have to ask you, now that I have my hands on you. This is the writer Peter Matheson, by the way, who lives here in Southampton. We're on the east end of Long Island in the Hamptons. So was he inspired by your book?
That's a question you would have had to ask Peter. I can only tell you that there's a description of the great white shark underwater in his book, which is very familiar to me. And also, I think he was a very good guy. I didn't know Peter. But he was a friend of one of my friends who was a diver on our white shark expedition. And when they made Jaws, the name of my book was Blue Meridian, and there was a copy of that book on the bedside table of the captain on the boat in Jaws. He put my book in the film. I took that as a polite say, hey, I did read your book, I liked it, and I was influenced by it.
The reason I brought that up is because in the end, I wonder if that shark was so menacing, if it didn't make people hate sharks more than ever, which I find particularly cruel. There's a kind of hatred about these poor creatures.
Yeah. There is. It was a very, very, I thought it was a pretty crude mechanical shark. it could go left and swing left or swing right. That was about it. Although it cost a fortune to build it. But it's true. It did inspire a hatred of sharks, unreasoning, the way wolves used to be hated, you know. Yeah. And I think that there's a guy called Captain Frank Mundus, who was a captain out in Montauk when I had my charter boat out there. And Mundus, actually, Frank, he was the one who kind of started the shark fishing craze. And people go out there, and there's thousands of sharks have been killed that way. And they're also hunted more and more commercially now for food. And I can remember, I've been fishing offshore since I was a little boy with my father. And I remember we would see 80, 90 sharks in a day without any trouble at all. And that's fins on the surface, big pelagic sharks. And you see one only here and there now, I'm told. But they bait for them. They put down bait and they come.
I know that you're a Buddhist, and when I was researching your life, it said something about a time during the Vietnam War when you joined other artists in signing a declaration, I think it was, of writers. Did you refuse to pay your taxes in protest of the Vietnam War?
Yeah, there was one period there, and that's what we did.
Were you against all wars or that one in particular?
Well, I'm against all wars, obviously. Who could be for war? It's insane behavior. But the Vietnam seemed to me particularly offensive. And the CIA naturally had a hand in that, some of the ugliest work in there. So,
I guess I asked about all wars because when I think back to, say, World War II, the Nazis, the concentration camps, I think to myself, I wasn't old enough, but I might have signed up. I might have fought in that war.
Well, from what we knew and what we knew what was going on in the so-called Holocaust and everything else, you had great reason to protest. And what the Japanese had done in Nanjing, and there was a lot of very evil stuff was being perpetrated. So I think in that sense, we were right. But of course, what always happens in war is that everybody puts their humanity on the shelf, and we end up bombing women and children in Dresden and Hamburg and Hiroshima. We killed millions of people. So I think for us to, it's true, I think our impulse for getting in the war was very, it was right, it was sincere and it was right, and it was very well done and we accomplished it, so forth. But we mustn't pretend that we behaved impeccably.
Yeah. This is the writer Peter Matheson, who lives here on the east end of Long Island. I was just talking with Amy Gross, who is the former editor of O Magazine, about meditation. She teaches it. And it made me think about you, because I wondered if Buddhism and meditation have taught you to listen in a more careful way to your inner voice with regard to your writing.
I think so. It does focus you. And I'm sorry to say that I abuse meditation, and I shouldn't do because I'm a teacher. But I do because I find that my mind becomes very clear and it focuses. And if I'm trying to work out some structural problem in a novel or something like that, I find it's a great, great place to do it. So I cheat a little bit.
I find that delightful. I find it delightful because sometimes I think it's like the world of wine. These rules come into play and, you know, people become so strict about how it must be done. And in the end, it's a fairly simple thing. So the fact that you sometimes abuse it, I like.
Good. Yeah, I used to have these thoughts. And in the old days when I was a student, when I was training in the Rinzai sect, and they were very strict, so I was worried about it. And I went to the Roshi at one point and said, listen, I'm doing this, and I don't seem to be able to control it. And I'm doing good work. And he said, you keep right on doing that. He said, do it, because that's the kind of Zazen too. As long as you are present and in the moment, you are doing that and really doing it.
Does what you write surprise you? Does it teach you what you think and feel?
Fiction does. Nonfiction, no. Occasionally, there's a book called The Snow Leopard, and that journey, that trek, a 250-mile walk over the Himalaya, that taught me a great deal, and I was learning things right and left. Usually, nonfiction doesn't do that, and fiction, but fiction does. You never know what's coming up next day, and that's what's exciting about it.
Yes.
It's out of your hands.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was talking with the fiction writer Alice Madison, and she says that her characters often boss her around. They tell her what they want to do, even if she feels they should do something else. And I looked at her. She said this to me a couple times, and I thought, is she pulling my leg? But she's deadly serious about it.
No, I think she's not. I think there's something in what she says. These characters, if you see them clearly, they become people. They become real people in your life. And a writer, you know, spends a great deal of time alone. And as I said in the preface to Shadow Country, I spent too much time in the mind of Mr. Watson, the protagonist. You do. You've begun to think like them, and you laugh at the same things. I made Watson, I think, pretty funny. I made him funny because it was much easier for me to write. It was entertaining if I gave him some good lines, you know. But anyway, he's there, and he becomes enormously real And you can't go against a character you've made. He's your character. He has to be in character, so to speak.
The actor Martin Sheen talked about, after doing West Wing, where he played the President of the United States, it was a favorite show of mine, that at home he actually had a hard time disabusing himself of the notion that he was president. He said it was really very difficult to separate.
He had the impulse to run for re-election.
When you did Wildlife in America back in the 1950s, this is the writer Peter Matheson, who lives out here on the east end of Long Island in Sagaponack, where we are right now. You were talking way back then in the 50s about the effects of global warming.
Yeah, I've been working as an environmentalist, conservationist all my life. And I wrote a book called Wildlife in America, in which I was talking about the ruin, and I'm already talking about oil pollution and big corporate damage to the environment and so forth. And not specifically about global warming, but it anticipated that because of the pollution. I mean, global warming, if it's climate change and if it's what we think it is, it's a pollution of the upper atmosphere. And so, I have been writing about it all my life, yeah.
You were married in a Buddhist ceremony, and I wondered how that's different from a traditional marriage ceremony.
Well, the way we did it is pretty informal. We adapt to what people's own tradition would teach, except that I ask for a minute or two of silence just to be with the people who are going to be married and be present and not be thinking about yesterday, what you're going to do tomorrow or your golf game or something, and just be there with this couple, you know, kind of thing. And we always have on the altar, we have water and incense and candle flower.
Is this you marrying someone else, you mean? When you're presiding?
What
about your wedding?
Oh, at my wedding, yes, I think we did all that. It was performed by my teacher, and we chanted. There are several, you know, Zen Buddhist chants, mantras, sutras. We do that, but that's rather brief. It's very flexible. You know, the secret of Buddhism is that they always co-opted every other religion. They said, oh, yeah, why don't you come and join us? We'll make you guards or the temple or something. And they are very flexible that way. They don't insist, on any particular protocol. They do, some of them do, and that's where, in Japan they do, but that's where Zen is already pretty dead, you know, because of that, and exactly what happens in the Christian church, too. When it becomes too rigid, as, if I may be indiscreet, the Vatican, I think that a great many of the Vatican protocol and rules are completely obsolete, and yet they're stuck with them. And that's when religions go dead.
And that's happening in Japan with Zen Buddhism?
It's happening in Japan with Zen, and I think it's happening in Rome.
Jason Epstein was just on talking about the future of books and as an editor for all his life. And he said the future will be about word of mouth on the internet, that people will talk in groups. And this is what will make people rush to buy books, that the old way of doing it, it just won't be the same anymore. And get ready. What do you think?
Well, I don't want to contradict Jason. He's a friend of mine. He was my editor, too, for a little while. But why is that so different from what's always happened?
People do. You mean word of mouth?
Word of mouth. People do talk. I've just been talking to you about Roberto Bolaño. And you might even pick it up, who knows. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think as he describes it, that is what's happening. And it's gonna. But I don't see that as a great...
I believe that word of mouth has always been the thing that makes a book sell. However, with the internet being what it is, it's so much faster and there's so many more people. It's not just one-on-one. You say to me, here is the book I'm reading. This is now... thousands, tens of thousands, millions of people talking. So it could have a tremendous effect and much more quickly look suspicious.
No, I'm just wondering what, if that's the case, why aren't people talking about my book?
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. How can I get in on that? Hey, what about life here on this is Peter Matheson, by the way, the writer. What about life here on the East End? There is, on the one hand, this astonishing beauty here on the east end of Long Island. And yet so many people, there are lots of working class people, there are lots of extremely wealthy people, but a lot of visitors. And I wonder how, on the one hand, you have a place of such beauty, and on the other hand, with all these people, protect what brings them here. How does that happen?
Well, we haven't entirely protected it. You know, when I'm like any old crab. I've been here for 50, 60 years now, and I'm in the same house. And when I first came, the road down to the beach from my house was still a dirt road, and there was no parking lot, Sagaponack, or anything like that. And it was all farmland, really. There were very few houses, and there were very few people who were not farm people. And that the one or two, and I made it three, and then a lot of writers came, I'm afraid, because of me. But they were also coming. There were a lot of painters when I got here. It was a painter's place more. And but it has and is changing to my taste very rapidly, not to the good. But nonetheless, there is a Long Island sort of spirit of preservation. I mean, I think the East Hampton Ladies Improvement Society, or whatever it is, Village Improvement, is terrific. They've done a very, very good job, and we have the group for the South Fork. I was in on the founding of that. And then we've had many groups, and so we are trying to hold back the tide. But the astounding thing to me is how this place lasted so long. Here it is, really less than 100 miles from New York, and it's been there forever. The most beautiful beach maybe in the world, and I've seen most of the coastlines of the world. It's an extraordinary beach, and it's extraordinarily fertile land, 18 inches of topsoil. You can grow anything here. I'm looking at a big crop right now of grapes out here. And why wasn't it, you know, East Hampton, Southampton? They've been resorts for 150 years, both of them. And yet people didn't move out here, and of course they didn't build year-round out here, generally speaking. And it really wasn't discovered, and then suddenly...
There you go. This is the writer Peter Matheson. Final question. Why have so many artists come here?
Well, I think for many reasons. I think that it is near New York, and that is the hub of the commercial end of art, I guess. It's where their agents are and their editors or their galleries if they're artists or whatever. I think it's that. They like to be near the beach, I guess, like everybody else. And then they attract one another. I mean Jackson Pollock and people like that. I lived in the Springs, which is east of here, beyond East Hampton. And in my commercial fishing days, I was over there. And there was all painters. There was Jackson and Bill de Kooning and all of them. And those were my original friends out here were the painters, because there weren't any writers to speak of.
Did you go to the parties, the drinking parties?
I did.
My conversation with the late author Peter Matheson, who died Saturday at age 86 on the east end of Long Island at his home in Sagaponack. His new book, In Paradise, will be published tomorrow by Riverhead Books. There is an essay about the fascinating life of Peter Matheson on our website right now, WNPR.org. Click Programs for the Faith Middleton Show. After a short break, the man Three American Buddhists seem to love, the author of People Tools, What You Need to Know to Get Along Well in the World.